Hello and welcome to The Stack. On this week's show, another iconic magazine is back to the newsstands, Playgirl. I speak with the title's editor-in-chief, Sky Parrott, plus Jeremy Leslie from Mac Culture and Snigdha Sur, founder of The Juggernaut, a wonderful title on all things South Asia. Enjoy the show. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up on the show, Jeremy Leslie previews his Mac Culture Live 2020 event, and I speak with Snigdha Sur on her publication chronicling the South Asian stories you need to know. But we start the show with an exciting new launch. Playgirl magazine is back. The iconic title that was founded in the 70s as a counterpart to Playboy had many iterations and is back as a yearly publication. The beautiful first issue features actress Chloe Sevigny 9 months pregnant on the cover, and it's a return to the feminist and provocative ways of the 1970s editions. I spoke to Playgirl magazine editor-in-chief Sky Parrott.
So the magazine originally launched in 1973, and it was conceived of as a feminist counterpart to Playboy of the 70s. So it was very smart, very political, very high level of contributors. Gloria Steinem was originally a contributor. Maya Angelou, Joyce Carol Oates, Robert Mapplethorpe shot for it. So it had this very political and feminist bent, but it also featured male nudity. So it was very provocative in that way and really wonderful. We archived the whole archives of the magazine, and we have them digitized, and it's been amazing exploring them. So from 73 to 76, it was this very dynamic feminist publication. And in 76, it was sold, and it continued along those lines, but a bit lighter, sort of a Cosmo, but with naked guys. So the content wasn't quite as hard-hitting. The journalism wasn't as in-depth. And then it was sold again, and it devolved over the years into its final incarnation, which was really a gay porn mag. And that's what I knew it as, and that's what I think a lot of people, as I've approached them to be part of it, have known it as. And it stopped publishing. Our publisher now is a young guy from a publishing family, and the opportunity to buy it fell into his lap, and he grabbed it. But he didn't have any experience producing a magazine, and so we were introduced by a mutual friend who got us together, and I had previously published a magazine called Dossier that he was familiar with, and I started working with him a little while after he bought it on the concept and then putting the team together, and now as editor-in-chief on the first issue.
And Sky, it's so interesting. I mean, there are quite a few examples, even here on The Stack, of magazines coming back to life in different forms, in different ways. For example, we had The Face recently. Mm-hmm. That just proves the power of magazines, right? I mean, they're clearly not dead. I mean, there's still space even for those iconic brands, such as Playgirl.
Yeah, so going into that first meeting, I have to say, our friend who introduced us at first didn't tell me what the magazine was. And when he did tell me, I was incredibly enthusiastic. And I went into that meeting just, I mean, with this idea that this magazine really should exist as kind of a feminist counterpart to Playboy of the 70s. And I went into the meeting very excited about that. And the publisher was like, yeah, but that's what it was originally. And I want it to be that again. So it was... It feels, with, you know, speaking to Playgirl in particular, like a very timely moment to bring it back. But I think there's a certain nostalgia attached to magazines in general. They're definitely an incredible force for building community and for connection. And I think there's something, as the world has become so digital, that really resonates about holding something physical. And I've thought about that a lot as we've been putting this together.
And which incarnation of Playgirl do you want to use it? I have a feeling perhaps a little bit of the 70s or some of the cheekiness of the 80s. What can you tell us about it? Because, of course, I know the magazine will be out quite soon.
So what we've been using as a template is that original 70s idea of something that's quite smart, quite political, unapologetically feminist, but also does, because it's Playgirl and it has a certain DNA of it related to nudity, of course, that's an issue that we have to look at with it as well. And so we've taken all those original ideas and tried to funnel them through a modern lens. So looking at questions of gender, looking at questions of representation, looking at the politics of all of those things, looking at the politics of the body, and really thinking about what constitutes a feminist and a feminine publication today. So that's been a really interesting exercise for the team. It's been very, very fun and challenging, and also exciting because I don't see there being another magazine or publication that occupies this particular space in the market, whether it's in print or digital. It really feels like a space that should be occupied, and the opportunity to look at what kind of content answers those questions has been a very exciting one.
And tell us, in terms of the format, will it be a biannual, or I mean, are you trying to make it a kind of a more premium product?
So the front of the book, as I said, is this series of first person essays, and they really are about a lot of different things. I mean, there's one about raising a single mother, raising a child with her family, kind of filling in the role of her partner, and there's another from the jewelry designer Pamela Love about sort of her external life not matching her internal life at the height of her business's success. And there's another one from the writer Carvel Wallace about how traditional masculinity constrains men and what a small box that is for men to have to fit in. So it's really a kind of variety of human experience. Ruth Reichel, the former editor-in-chief of Gourmet, wrote a beautiful essay about traveling with her women friends as they've aged together. So it's really varied, but really beautiful first-person essays, and those are all illustrated. And then we have the large portfolio in the magazine, which is a multimedia portfolio that explores the question of desire. So we've asked different artists and creatives to contribute pieces that look at that question. You know, that was a really interesting one because we wanted to, you know, we've referenced back a lot to the original DNA of the magazine, but I had a feeling when we sent that question out, what we got back would be very different than just straight up content about sex. And it really hasn't, it's been very little about sex. Most people's desires relate to having climate change dealt with or living in a world that's not a disaster. And so we've gotten back a lot of answers like that. We did a wonderful portfolio that's really the heart of the issue that looks at feminist heroes. So it's women who have devoted their time and their energies to lifting up other women through their work. And so that's, we've included Alicia Garza, who's one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter, and Sarah Sophie Flicker, who's one of the organizers from the Women's March, and Amanda Decadene, who founded Girl Gaze, and a woman named Ai-Jen Poo, who's a co-founder of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. So really a variety of women who are doing incredible work in activism and using their energies for good. And we've thought about that thread a lot, the idea of what constitutes kind of female power and how female power can be utilized in the world for good. And we do have a centerfold in the issue.
I was going to ask that.
Yeah,
because a lot of people have been asking me when I say, oh, you know, Playgirl is back. And they yeah. I think some people have this image in their head of, like, I don't know, Tone Selleck. Was he in there?
He wasn't actually in Playgirl.
He wasn't.
So that was in...
Sorry.
No, everyone thinks it. I thought it too.
Yeah.
I believe it was actually in Cosmo,
okay.
That one.
Okay.
But... yeah, so we did. I think the magazine is so closely associated with the idea of a centerfold that we really had to address that. But the way we've done it is we have a portfolio shot by the photographer Harley Weir, where she's looked at different male bodies. And
she's excellent.
She's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the portfolio is really beautiful. Although we do have an actual centerfold that folds out, and it's really funny and provocative and great. So, I mean, the centerfold was something I wasn't sure of as we went into it, but our creative director was quite sure that he wanted to include it, and so was our publisher. And so I think the way that we've finally done so is really funny and sexy and good.
I'm very excited about that as well, because, you know, let's be honest, the magazine used to have quite a big gay readership as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there's also perhaps one of the people that might like to buy that.
Well, so what's interesting actually is in reaching out to contributors and editors, gay men have been one of the most enthusiastic audiences. And I don't know, the whole magazine actually opens with It's a first-person essay that explores the history of Playgirl, and it's kind of a macro and a micro look at it, because the writer, T. Cole Rachel, talks about his experiences with Playgirl growing up as a queer kid in Oklahoma, where he would find it and like surreptitiously look at it, but then also looking at the greater cultural context of it. And it's a really wonderful essay, and I think I've loved the enthusiasm men have to contribute to it. And one interesting thing, though, the Desire portfolio that I mentioned, that's one space that we have not found a lot. We did not find a lot of guys willing to approach that subject. So it's been an interesting exercise to kind of see where, you know, where there are differences and what people of different genders and persuasions want to, you know, want to see and want to engage on.
That was Sky Parrott from Playgirl magazine. The first issue is out now. And now I've stopped by at the Mag Culture shop here in London to speak with the Stack regular Jeremy Leslie. Besides buying a few of the great titles that he stocks over there, I spoke to Jeremy about his latest plans, including his upcoming event, Mag Culture Live 2020, happening on the 18th and the 19th of November. Let's have a listen.
So obviously the whole kind of year has been a strange one from the very beginning, but the summer went quiet. We had a lot of online sales, but now we're sort of feeling back to normal. We're just slightly anxious because we don't quite know now what's going to happen over the weeks. Now there's been another sort of semi lockdown, but things are good. Things have been good at the moment. I think the best thing, the most reassuring thing, is one, that a lot of regular customers are in and out, but two, lots of new magazines are still coming through. You know, people, there's been a few delays in publication, but we've just had the new issues of things, you know, the Gentlewoman and the Fantastic Man, slightly later than normal in the year, but they're here and selling well. Appartamento's about to land, plus lots of, you know, there's newer magazines, new launches coming through. So we're busy. It's good. We feel good.
Well, I'm sure our listeners will be very happy to hear that Mag Culture Live is back in a very different format, but that's quite exciting news. Explain to us how different will it be from the other years, and this is the eighth one, right?
It is the eighth one. The eighth one in London. We've done two in New York, and we were just at the point of lockdown. We were supposed to be doing our third New York conference, and we had to first postpone and then wake up and cancel it. But we did do an experiment at that time where we did a small version of the conference using Zoom. And that was very successful, a bit like what I'm talking about in terms of the Instagram Lives. What we lacked in kind of community, we gained in reach. And so now with the London edition, it's not really the London edition, it's now the international, it's now the kind of online, everybody can join in edition. With that, it's a bit more ambitious than what we did instead of the New York one. It's a two-day event, but that's not double the quantity. We're taking what would normally be, I mean, you've been to enough of them, a whole day of talks live on stage. We're splitting that in two across two late afternoons on the 18th and 19th of November. Each three-hour session will have its own theme, and attendees can join us online via Zoom to either with a ticket for one night or both nights. And so, we're trying to, you know, we want to keep it going, and there's no way. I mean, even if the current rules would allow us to hold the event, I'm not sure I'd be very comfortable, and I'm sure our audience wouldn't be particularly comfortable to be in a busy room of 300 people, you know, for a day. It's not fit for purpose at the moment. So we're adapting to the online environment and excited by what that can offer in terms of a much more international mix of speakers and a much more international mix of attendees.
And the two topics, I mean, for each day, I think they're so 2020, if I may say that. Yeah. One is activism and the other one is analog. Yes. If you can go through perhaps the panels. I mean, the activism one, it's true, because at the same time we had the year of the pandemic, but then we've been discussing so many social issues, related to race, gender, among other things as well.
On the Wednesday 18th, it'll be activism, and then Thursday the 19th is analog. And I think both kind of highlight the two key parts of what we celebrate with Mag Culture Live. On the first day, it's kind of probably more of an editorial bent in terms of looking at the themes and the abilities of magazines to provide platforms for points of view, historically and in a contemporary sense. And then the following day, the analog side, I mean, that sort of reflects more on the art direction and design trends that we're noting at the moment. To give you an example, on the activism side, we'll be opening with the US design critic and academic Stephen Heller will be giving us kind of historical context to what magazines have managed to do over the years in terms of providing voices to for activists. And then we'll be sort of jumping right into the now with the co-founder of Dean Journal, Alice Grandoit. And her magazine is it looks at diversity in design. And then we will, and we've got a number of other speakers, including, I'm particularly excited to have Maya from Safa Journal, which is based in Beirut. Not only is that a fantastic magazine trying to develop conversations of creativity in Lebanon, but they've also, of course, been through their own very, very distinct disaster with the bombing in the harbour that has not only damaged and killed a lot of people, but has left Safa themselves without their office. So that's a very pertinent current subject. Then we'll also be looking back in time again with David King, who was a graphic designer who did a lot of work with the Anti-Nazi League and Rock Against Racism in the 70s and 80s. And he's a fantastic book has just been published of his work. So the writer of that book, Rick Poyner, is going to be presenting some of his work with a particular emphasis on the covers that he did for City Limits magazine, a left-wing listings magazine from the 80s. And then we come right up to contemporary times with Sakine Imbaldaneya, who's the founder of Studio Pi, which is a new creative agency supporting photographers and illustrators from outside the normal realms of people that get access to the publishing world. We all know how white and almost exclusively white the publishing world is. Well, this is a project which is based on Sak's own experience as an Asian woman growing up and building her career in publishing. She's now putting her experiences to good by helping illustrators and photographers who don't normally get to be seen. And there's some fantastic work there. So I'm very interested to be in conversation with her, talking about what we can do to change that.
That's amazing. And then you have also the analog one, which again, it's what you do. It's what we do. We both love magazines. Yes. And you know, and still the value of print, even during lockdown, I think people, they wanted, I'm sure they made their orders here at Mac Culture, you know, to have something to read. Yes. At home. So that was that's another very important panel as well.
I mean, obviously magazines are analog entities in the most basic sense anyway, but we've noted a number of projects recently where the way that computers kind of, to a degree, overwhelm the makeup and layout of our pages that are generally in magazines, that context has been challenged by a number of art directors and people working who are trying to break down that kind of digital, overwhelmingly digital look that magazines have. So very excited to be joined by Chloe Sheffy, who does a lovely little travel magazine called Here, where she scans and manipulates type manually before scanning it in and using it within the computer layout within InDesign. But also Kurt Werpol, who's the art director at Interview Magazine, will be joining us, and they've been doing fantastic things in terms of layout and, again, mixing, adding handmade elements to the pages. And then Jack Self will be looking at the beautiful front cover images that they use on The Real Review. And then, you know, we'll zero right in on a very particular project, which our friends UMPC fanzine and the Rabbits Road Press, they provide access to and train people to express themselves using print. And these are people that, again, are outside the usual publishing world who don't get access to the analog process of making risograph printing. And then finally, on across both days, on the Wednesday, we've got the kind of keynote talk from Terry White, who's the editor-in-chief of Empire, the movie magazine. And on Thursday, we've got Oliver Munday, who is the creative director at The Atlantic in the States.
That was Jeremy Leslie from Mac Culture. For more information about Mac Culture Live 2020, go to macculture.com. And finally on the show, I had the pleasure to speak with Snigdha Sur, founder of The Juggernaut, an online publication chronicling South Asian stories, from the politics of Indian punk to the rise of South Asian Americans running for office. Think Kamala Harris. Here is Snigdha with more.
The Juggernaut is a new media publication and community that centers South Asian stories. And so when we say South Asian, we mean the general South Asian subcontinent of India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, the Maldives, Sri Lanka, Nepal, Bhutan, sometimes even Afghanistan and Burma or Myanmar. And the reason we center these stories is because, you know, there are, this sounds crazy to say, but there's like over 1.9 billion of us. Many of us are also part of the world's largest diaspora. So people living outside those countries, but all over the world. And that's over about 50 million strong. But when you look at mainstream media, just because we tend to be sometimes the smallest populations are quite small in different countries, such as England or even in the US, the media just doesn't center our stories as much as they could. And so we wanted to kind of highlight these stories, go deeper, provide more nuance. We just reported on the story of Chippendales, which was actually started by an Indian man from Bombay, India, who came to LA and was like, let me bring some of the traditions of the Bombay dance bars here. So there's so many interesting stories that are part of our everyday lives that center these people and the culture and the history and politics. And we wanted to bring that to the general population. It's truly for everyone. Anyone who's interested or remotely curious, we welcome you. It's not just for people of South Asian descent.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say, because that's how it felt like. I mean, I'm sure people with South Asian descent, they will be interested, of course. But, you know, but even, you know, someone like me, I'm a guy from Brazil living here in London. It's indeed stories that I haven't come across, you know, in the traditional papers. For example, there's this lovely profile of this actress, which I know you were excited about, Sarita Choudhury. I mean, I loved finding out a little bit more about her. You know, I know she's doing quite well at the moment as well.
Yes. So Sarita Choudhury, she was a marvel to speak to. I got to speak to her a few weeks ago. She just came out in a horror movie from Blumhouse Productions and also produced by Priyanka Chopra Jonas, where they look at the traditions of the East and West through very interesting ways and make it into a horror film. And Sarita Choudhury's debut, however, was in Mississippi Masala, directed by Meera Nair. And it came out in 1991, and it co-starred Denzel Washington. And this is one of the first and probably very few movies coming from Hollywood that depicts an interracial couple where none of the, you know, leads are white. And it just really changes the conversation. She was stunning and a wonder to watch. I highly recommend everybody go and watch this movie. And she's had a 30-year trajectory. And in this profile, we ask, what if Sarita Choudhury had debuted in 2020? What would her life have looked like? Because when she came out, people didn't know what to do with her, she says in an interview, right? Hollywood didn't know what to do with her. They would like say, is she Mexican? Is she Hispanic? Is she Indian? What do we do with her? And that's kind of incredible to see how cinema has changed in even 30 years, where we're hopefully not asking that question anymore, where we're really, you know, embracing diversity and embracing different people and incorporating the fact that our world does not look like what we think it looks like on screen, right? And I also want to talk a little bit about the fact that many of these people have a strong fan following, but they don't really see it because it's not, it's like this vicious cycle where Hollywood isn't producing those movies, right? And then they never get to see it in the theaters to kind of have that reaction. So I really loved interviewing her, and I hope more people like her get their stories told.
Snigdha, another thing that I'm really interested, tell us about the business model for the Juggernaut. Of course, you guys have a paywall, which to be honest, you know, it's a trend that is here to stay, because I think a lot of journalists are realizing that, you know, their content shouldn't be exactly just for free, you know. So tell us a bit more about the business side of things at the Juggernaut.
Yes, we started with a hard paywall. So very similar to The Information or The Athletic, where we ask, we give everyone a free 7-day trial, but we do ask for your credit card information up front. You have a 7-day free trial to cancel at any time. And then if you really like us, come and stay. And the reason we started the paywall is to kind of think about initial conditions. It's so much harder to start free and then ask people to pay. I don't know if you've noticed this, because it means that you've cultivated a certain audience that is expecting something for free, and then you're asking them to pay for the same thing. It's so much easier to start the other way. And so we wanted to start with the paywall because A, we wanted our audience to understand that 77% of newsrooms in America are non-Hispanic white. Over 90% of our journalists are people of color. So we've just completely reversed those metrics. And on the other side of the paywall, we're paying journalists and illustrators. And I think it's really important to pay people responsibly, quickly, as much as you possibly can. And that's what we try to do. And that's what this has allowed us to do, is it's a more predictable revenue model to understand how we can pay journalists and illustrators on the other side. And I want to get our customers used to that, right? It's really important to pay for great journalism. And I get that not everyone can afford it. We totally understand that. And we're hoping down the line, you heard it here first, to release other products that can help address those needs. We do have a free weekly newsletter that goes out on Sunday for everybody for free, where we round up the news, which we think is really important. And we also kind of feel that it's really important for people who are so able to pay it forward and allow for journalists and great illustrators to do their work.
And Znigna, I'll just leave the thought there. I mean, did you ever think about doing a print edition of the Juggernaut?
I love that question. It's been on my mind for a really long time. I think we would definitely be down to do special editions. So, you know, the holiday season is coming up and I've been thinking about in my head, like, do we do a special edition of some of the 10 best articles from the Juggernaut and put that out there? I think on a more regular cycle, it might be difficult for us because we've just started, but I could totally see us doing special editions just for people to share it, see it and, you know, have a physical copy of it and, you know, enjoy it, you know, in the beauty of sometimes being non-plugged in. So yes, definitely a possibility, but we haven't done it yet.
And Snigna, we're discussing some kind of, you know, entertainment stories and everything. I wonder, you know, you're speaking to the South Asian community there in the US. Will you touch on politics as well? You know, you have the election coming up as well. So I'm just curious about that.
That's such a great question. We do cover politics. So about 86% of our subscribers are from the US, but we also have subscribers in the UK and some other countries as well. In terms of the upcoming elections, you know, this year we have a very historic VP candidate. We have Kamala Harris, who is of Indian and Jamaican descent, and it's a huge deal for our community. So we've actually covered it in a couple of ways. We've talked a little bit, we've interviewed a bunch of folks to see what their views are on this candidacy, as well as, you know, the other incumbent that shall not be named. And we've also done a few partnerships. We've worked with The Guardian to release a story on how the South Asian American voter electorate is feeling. And we're also working with 538 to do a story on campaign financing to see how South Asians are donating with their money. So even if they might be a small part of the electorate, there's about 2 million specifically Indian American voters. And many of them tend to be in the coasts, right? Where because we have electoral college system, it might seem like our votes don't matter. But many South Asian Americans are increasingly donating their money. And that's really important to follow that. So we're really excited about that feature coming out as well. But in general, I think this has been a really exciting time to cover so many things in relation to this community and these stories. And we're excited about some of the politics coverage we've come out with that. So definitely check out the Juggernaut for that.
Well, I think the idea for the Juggernaut is super interesting. And I guess if our listeners are interested, you know, they just go to your website and I'm sure there will be all the details there to subscribe, right?
100%. Come to our website to subscribe. Even before that, you can follow us on social media, on Instagram and Twitter. We hear we have a very good Instagram. It's really fun. People have a lot of fun with it. And we're really known for explaining and breaking down a ton of things. I would also say that some of our best ideas come from our readers and even casual followers who are curious about a question. And that's kind of how the Juggernaut came about. I was reading, I'm a huge news nerd, and I'd read a lot of news and I'd have all these questions. And I'm like, who's answering these questions? You know, in a deep, nuanced way. And I couldn't find that. So come and, you know, come and tell us, give us the feedback.
That was Nigda Sur from the Juggernaut. Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Nora Hall. And if you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fp@monaco.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, meanwhile, you can always listen to it again or subscribe to the show at monaco.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and SoundCloud. Before we go, a little song for you. It always makes me happy to hear this. Sister Sledge with All American Girls. And for our North American listeners, have a good election. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye for me. We're all-